Oh, the money tree, the money tree. It's a beautiful sight.
So this week is going to be an interesting one. Jason, as we've been talking about, we have a lot of Fed speakers at that NABE conference in Boston. Jay Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, will be making some comments. So it'll be interesting to see how rates or the fixed income world reacts. Let's get into some of this with Henley Smith, back with us, Vice President and Senior Relationship Manager at Stonecastle Cash Management, $14.2 billion in assets under management, back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Nice to have you back with us.
Well, thanks. The cash investment guy is back again.
Cash.
It has been. It's actually becoming quite the asset.
You can actually make money on cash nowadays.
It's amazing after 10 years of zero interest rates, and finally we're 2+, and I think people are starting to look at cash with a much more vigor and much more exciting now.
Are they looking, or are they actually committing?
They're committing. I mean, I think institutional clients that we have, their operating funds, reserve funds, are pretty static. I mean, we're seeing some clients, repatriating funds are coming back in, but I'm seeing the real difference on the home and the family office world, in the internet or in the individual world, where people are starting to take a little off the table, and now that cash is paying 2+, it's real money again. So I think that's kind of a little bit exciting, especially a guy like me that's been in this field of business for
it's
a long
pretty
time.
Pretty quiet, right?
So you have seen these sort of cycles come and go, Henley. Like what is it about now, beyond obviously interest rates starting to creep up, but the macro environment, or some micro issues that are pushing people a little bit more toward that? You have to have, I would imagine, your business a very keen sense of all sorts of economic indicators. What's jumping out to you at this point?
Well, again, I think it's people have just, we've experienced this expansion for a long time. We've been arguing, are we in the seventh inning? Are we in the ninth inning? When is the recession going to happen? I think there's been a lot of speculation about that. Bringing it back to the sports analogy, hopefully we're in extended innings, which would be nice. But I'm getting just a sense from individuals that we've had a great run. 2008 has always been in the back of people's minds. So I think this time, people being a little bit more reserve, a little bit more protective, are willing to take a little bit off the table and just kind of be flexible here. So that's the real key word, I think. It's liquidity, flexibility. I'm going to give up a little bit to, maybe I'm going to be wrong, I'm not going to catch the top of the market, but in 2-3 years time, I'm going to feel a lot better.
As we mentioned, there is that event by the National Association for Business Economics underway in Boston. 2/3 of business economists in the U.S. expecting a recession to begin by the end of 2020. What is it that takes the economy off track? Is it just a case of the Fed doing too much? Yeah, what do you anticipate will be the thing that...
Well, it sounds like, we've took away that accommodative phrase last week. It looks like we're kind of moving into this gray neutral area. Who knows what that is? Will the Fed tip us over into a recession by tightening too quickly? And I think that's a concern right now. So, fundamentally, it seems fundamentally, we're still hitting on all cylinders. Wages is the one thing that has been a paradox for this Fed, but seems to be picking up a little bit. My concern would be is if the Fed gets behind inflation too much and has to kind of be catch up a little bit, and that could kind of knock things off course, I think. Right now, there's no reason not to argue with the Fed. They've been very transparent. They've been very deliberate, 25 basis points every quarter. We expect another 25 basis points in December. All things are pointing to that again, which has been great. But who knows what that, and I don't want to use the term black swan, but who knows what that event's going to be. It's probably out there somewhere.
But will it be a black swan event? That seems kind of extreme.
It probably does. It's probably an extreme term, but there's probably something out there. Even in 2008, there was a lot of things that happened unexpectedly that we weren't thinking about, things that were safe and liquid that weren't, that really knocked 2008 over the top. And so I'm not anticipating that right now, but it's something to be aware of.
And you mentioned the transparency that we're getting from the Fed, and certainly Carol and I have been talking a lot about kind of this plain spoken chairman that we now have versus a couple of his more recent predecessors. What do you make of the Jay Powell Fed? What's the signature at this point, other than sort of transparency and this sort of deliberate nature?
Yeah, well, that's certainly it. I mean, he's still relatively new, but I mean, again, he's just kind of taking the page out of the playbook that was presented to him. There's no reason to change it at this point. Obviously, as we've talked about before, I grew up with a Greenspan and a Volcker Fed where everyone was trying to guess what was going on at the time. It made it fun as a trader. It was a lot of fun.
Right, Greenspan speak.
Exactly, trying to figure out exactly what he was saying. So I find it refreshing. As a portfolio manager, I find it refreshing because you can plan and do things that are but as a trader, you know, obviously you want to see a little more volatility in the market to trade and make some money. So I guess right now it's still too early, but I do find it refreshing, and there's no reason to fight this Fed at this point.
Kind of interesting too, you mentioned like Black Swan event. I just want to go back there because it's kind of, some of the folks that we've talked to said, you know, if we get some kind of downturn, it might be like a little bit of a speed bump or a little pothole. Like we'll hit it and we'll bounce right back. There's a lot of resiliency out there. How do you see it playing out, though?
I would say the same thing. I mean, we had read this week that we had like a mini recession this, you know, the second quarter, and it kind of came back. And that's kind of been what we've seen over the last couple of years. The first quarter has been weak, and then it's popped back. I mean, I think the things that we're doing now economically, fundamentally, suggest that, you know, the economy is in strong footing. Let's get those wages up a little bit, or a lot of bit, I should say, and you know, go from there. But there's nothing out there on the horizon that I can see other than, you know, the trade war becomes crazy, but it looks like we're resolving that here today.
Right.
It seems like those tactics are working. Is there something from the emerging market that is a problem? Perhaps, but again, that's probably a small piece of what's going on. So
yeah.
I would think domestically, comfortable. The only thing that we're doing is, again, it's getting long in the tooth.
Henley Smith, Vice President and Senior Relationship Manager at Stonecastle Cash Management, $14.2 billion in assets under management in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. All right, everybody, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. We know President Trump celebrated a trade deal with Canada and Mexico to replace NAFTA as a historic win that really vindicated his strategy of threatening tariffs on trade partners. Certainly one of the stories we're following on this Monday. The new agreement makes modest revisions to NAFTA. We want to get into it with our next guest. Stefan Selig is managing partner at Bridge Park Advisors, former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade at the U.S. Department of Commerce during the Obama administration, with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. This trade deal, it's minor changes, right? Minor tweaks?
Well, it's a redo, Carol. It's not a do-over. That being said, NAFTA did need to be modernized, and this is a real win for the president and the administration, and we should give them credit for that.
And so what's the most important element of this? What's the biggest thing that's different that will make a meaningful difference in the U.S. economic sense?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we didn't leave NAFTA, which we threatened to do, which would have been vitally disruptive to supply chains. So to me, the biggest win is the absence of a problem, which was leaving NAFTA. Now, as it relates to, you know, the U.S. MCA, which they are calling it, is helpful for U.S. dairy farmers. They are going to have greater access than they had before. And there are going to be a whole host of provisions, frankly, many of which were consistent with what we had already negotiated in TPP relating to intellectual property protections, to the digital economy, and labor environmental standards, all of which are good for U.S. businesses and workers.
So a good thing, bottom line?
For sure a good thing, bottom line.
Because you would concede that things needed to be tweaked a little bit.
For sure. And I would say think about it, 25 years ago, what the economy looked like compared to what it looked like today. And so this is something that needed to get done. I'm not sure we needed all the Sturm und Drang around it to get here.
Right.
But good for us. And hopefully, by the way, it's not done because it still has to get through all three legislative bodies, you know, which could be a real challenge in our country, certainly, depending on what happens in our upcoming midterms.
Does it say anything to you about what we might get between the U.S. and China, where we've seen trade tensions just kind of escalating?
Unfortunately not. You know, the China issues are far more complex, Carol. You know, don't forget, Canada is a market economy. It's one of our closest allies. And we have actually reasonably few areas of disagreement where we actually have some fundamental issues with China that are going to be hard to address. You know, even if you think about those things that we were asking of Canada, they were reasonably specific.
Right.
Well, the things we're asking of China are not particularly specific. They are, we want to reduce our trade deficit. Okay, well, how are we going to do that? And how are we going to do that in the context of dealing with a non-market economy of that size?
So you are uniquely qualified to talk about this because you were in the Commerce Department under President Obama, and as well as a deal maker for a long time here on Wall Street. The way this sausage is getting made this time around, what's your sense of it? Is this the most effective way to do it? I mean, does the end essentially justify the drama, the Sturm und Drang, as you said?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, first of all, who knows? Because right. You can't kind of go back and say where we would have ended up if we would have done it in a more kind of collegial,
linear
fashion. If in fact, you know, we did get better market access in dairy than we were able to negotiate under TPP. So I think you could fairly say that there were some provisions that that the administration was able to achieve that past administrations had not been able to achieve. That being said, you know, there are some real relationship breakage that happened along the way. And, you know, you always ask yourself as a deal maker, is the light worth the candle? And we'll see.
It's interesting because you do sound, you're saying that, you know, we certainly have made some advancements here. And I'm just curious, if we had left, would we have left things kind of as is without a Trump administration? Or were we moving towards, we've got to start relooking at these trade deals that were getting a little bit old and we were now living in different times?
You know, don't forget, both Mexico and Canada were signatories, or were going to be signatories to TPP, and right. are signatories to the TPP minus
That's
the
true.
United States. So we were addressing a lot of these issues, and a lot of these advancements we had already negotiated, which is why this shouldn't have been such a complicated, contentious negotiation to start with. So I do think that you know, any administration would have gotten around to addressing some of these issues. But a lot of that, as I said, would have already been done if we would have stuck with TPP. And maybe if we rename TPP and
US.
Call it, well, or the right. Trump Pacific Partnership.
Yeah. Right.
Maybe that can get done. And that would
happen.
Be also great for our country.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, which is we got a trilateral deal here. But multilateral has been among the dirtiest words that you can say in Washington in this administration. Is there a case to be made? Is it reasonable to think that there is sort of the time and the appetite to do bilateral by bilateral by bilateral deal in the world we're living in now?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's going to take time. Don't forget, we do not have a trade agreement with Japan.
Right.
So we do have a trade deficit with Japan. We do not have a trade agreement. So this notion that we've negotiated the worst trade agreements that have led to these deficits is a little bit confusing and nonlinear, as you've pointed out. But, you know, look, in the absence of doing TPP, would you go around and try and make bilateral deals with some of those biggest, most important economies? Yes. The question really is, in a multilateral deal, does that give us more leverage
right.
and more power vis-a-vis China? And so even with some of those smaller economies, would it, like Vietnam, for example, where also we don't have a trade agreement, would that have been helpful to us in battling what is going
to be? Because they are a party to TPP, correct?
They are a party to TPP.
Well, that's what I was wondering. In a world where there are these big multilateral agreements, you know, is the U.S. still being left behind?
Well, for sure. I mean, as evidenced by the fact that the other 10 countries decided to, you know, go on without it. That being said, you know, without the U.S. economy and the ballast of the U.S. economy as part of the revised TPP, it's not going to have nearly the same impact, both for the remaining signatories of that agreement and also as a counterpoint to China without the U.S.
I think we have to leave it there.
I think we do.
What are you following next, though, on the trade front? Just quickly, 30 seconds.
It would be Europe, to see if we make progress with Europe and with Japan. The president has talked about bilateral trade agreements with both. Don't forget, and I spent a tremendous amount of time trying to do a U.S.-EU trade deal. Maybe we would go back to that. I don't know if that's a bilateral deal or a multilateral deal. It depends on if you think of the EU as one entity or a confederation of states. But that could also be extraordinarily helpful and powerful.
Good stuff, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Much appreciated. Stefan Selig, he's managing partner over at Bridge Park Advisors, former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade at the U.S. Department of Commerce during the Obama administration. Monday.
Whew, we made it.
Yes, we did.
A lot of CEO turnover, some trade deals, news out of Washington. We're just getting started for the week, Carol.
Got some Fed speakers coming up, so stick around. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.